I'm Reverend Lisa Day, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Welcome to our weekly radio program, where you'll hear a segment from one of our recent services recorded at our church on beautiful Troop Square. We invite you to join us Sundays at 11 a.m. in person or via live stream on Zoom. You can find the Zoom link and more about Unitarian Universalism in Savannah at our website, uusavannah.org. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. I'm Abby Powell, and I'll be serving as worship associate today. Our minister, Reverend Lisa Day, is our worship leader this morning. Our choir is on a summer break. Here at the UU Church of Savannah, we are working to build a diverse, multicultural, and beloved community. We celebrate the presence and participation of people of all races, genders, sexual orientations, abilities, and ethnic and national origins. We warmly welcome you on YouTube and on site, whoever you know yourself to be, and wherever you are on your journey. With the lighting of our chalice, symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith, we enter into sacred time. And our chalice lighting words today are an original prayer by Richard Fuchs. For the sun and the dawn, which we did not create, for the moon and the evening, which we did not make, for food which we plant but cannot grow, for friends and loved ones we have not earned and cannot buy, for this gathered company which welcomes us as we are from wherever we have come, for all our free churches that keep us human and encourage us in our quest for beauty, truth, and love, for all things which come to us as gifts of being from sources beyond ourselves, gifts of life and love and friendship, we lift up our hearts in thanks this day.
Now we are here. Now at last we are here. Again, or for the very first time, expectant, grateful, joyous. Our very bones settle in with the ease of belonging. A sigh of unconsciously held breath releases, and our hearts prepare to feast on the holiness of this hour. Come, let us worship together. On a day when life is beautiful and terrible, and we are too. On a day when questions outnumber answers, and we can't tell one from the other anyway. On a day when the news is heavy and our spirits are yet still buoyant. On a day when tidings rejoice and our hearts cannot. On a day when friends and neighbors celebrate, mourn, and we along with them. On a day when change looms unseen and unbidden, and we live as though nothing ever changes. On a day when the sky is strange and we feel alien in our own home. On a day, an ordinary day such as today, we fall silent amidst all we know and before all we do not know. And in the silence, listen, that we might come to know one thing more and 100 things less. Our first reading this morning is longer than usual, but it's important, so settle in. It appears on the website of the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University, actually earlier this month, by Eva Jones, and is entitled Continuities and Developments in Anti-Trans Efforts and Resistance. And these are excerpts from that article. In the past 5 years, more anti-trans legislation has been proposed in the United States than in the previous 200 years combined. Attacks on gender nonconformity and trans life are nothing new, but strategies and anxieties of contemporary transphobia have evolved, surging into a tidal wave of paranoia and repression. Religious, governmental, medical, and educational institutions presented an onslaught of legal and cultural attacks on trans lives around the globe in the 2020s. In the face of increasingly organized and sophisticated attacks on trans existence, a panel of scholars in the field of trans studies, gender, sexuality, and women's studies, and history talked about the historicity of the current anti-trans movement in the United States and the vestiges of historical gender regulation. They noted that trans persistence represents continuance in the face of social, economic, and legal enforcement of traditional gender. It is this continuance of trans bodies, trans memory, and trans life that is under surge by the current current anti-trans moral panic. It is not just that trans existence is under attack, but the historical record of transness is being denied as well. In the context of the contemporary anti-trans moral panic, transness has been subject to politically forced amnesia to make transness seem new. Such attacks are not new. Rhetorical similarities exist between the contemporary anti-trans movement and the Nazis' crackdown of state control in the name of common sense or protecting common people. By making these claims, Nazis invented a common sense about gender that was, in fact, contrary to the prevailing science of the era and trends in social acceptance. Anti-trans groups of today have founded shadow professional organizations like the American College of Pediatrics, a conservative advocacy group that capitalizes on their name's similarity to the older, larger, and nonpartisan American Academy of Pediatrics, to manufacture institutional expertise and to funnel transphobic obsessions through channels of legitimacy. Prior to the 1990s, most anti-trans rhetoric castigated trans people for being strange, promiscuous, or queer. But today, discrete language and practices for gender transition are often the explicit core of anti-trans policy and animus. Today, legislative and social attacks are outright barring practices or mentions of gender transition. One possible explanation for such a shift could be the new language and visibility of trans life in the 21st century. Opponents of trans rights have used this new language to recycle old homophobia, framing trans people's existence as a sort of conspiratorial attack on children, women, family life, and even a stable world order. Political ostracization or media sensationalization of trans lives have occurred before, but now ordinary members of the public have deputized themselves as enforcers of gender rather than spectators of rare gender phenomenon. The panel provided critical attention to both the historical continuities and the modern evolutions of transphobia and illuminated the stakes of confusing the two. The panel members suggested that coordinated attacks also call into question a rights-based approach to social inclusion. Instead, we must engage in community building to support trans people's well-being that doesn't depend on a government to confer or withhold rights. The second reading comes from Unitarian Universalist minister Hannah Roberts Villeneuve, who posted on Facebook in June of 2025. The Supreme Court says that you can opt your kid out of knowing that my family exists. That you can opt your kid out of cognitive dissonance between reality and belief. Good luck. But as a parent, I think a lot more about what we're opting our kids into. What we're trying to make sure is in their lives so that they can learn to love this world both as it is and as it could be. The hard way. The hard way is the only way, I regret to admit. We're opting into a church community that loves them thoroughly, but also knows they need help growing and remembering to use walking feet during coffee hour. We're opting them into friends whose parents have open doors and open hearts. We're opting them into a network of queer grown-ups that is vast and varied and normalized so that I'm pretty sure my kids are bored by it. We're opting them into a world where disagreement is not disrespect, but where we've got to put in the work to make that true. We're opting them into love and knowing that sometimes what love asks will make us feel uncomfortable, out of control, and on the edge. So go ahead, opt your kid out of knowing that my family exists. We'll be over here opting in because that's what my religious beliefs demand. Here end the readings. If you are about my age or older, you remember back before backspace and delete, before word processing, before that magic tape in a Brother electric typewriter that could somehow lift a typed character from the page, but only one or two characters back and only if the type bars were perfectly aligned. Back before whiteout. Back when there were typewriter erasers. Typically disc-shaped pink erasers attached to stiff plastic brushes, though some of the later ones were pencil-shaped with a stiff plastic brush at the opposite end of the cylinder. The thing to know about typewriter erasers, if you've never used one, is their incredible ineffectiveness, at least in my hands. Typewriter ink wasn't designed to be erasable. Rubbing at it hard enough to remove a typo often resulted in a smudgy, discolored spot on the paper at best, a hole worn completely through the paper at worst. Whiteout was an improvement, but a bright white spot remained as evidence of the letter, word, or words that had been covered up but not actually removed. The ink-removing tape of my Brother typewriter was better still, though, as I mentioned, it had flaws and limitations. Now, much, if not most, of our writing is done on keyboards and appears on screens, and we can erase with the tap of a delete button or use the cut function for larger chunks of text. Still, cybersecurity experts tell us practically nothing is ever truly irretrievable, at least not to an expert at such things. I've been thinking about typewriter erasers and the other methods of removing text, but mostly typewriter erasers, a lot recently. I thought about them when I heard earlier this month that the United States Air Force would deny all transgender service members who have served between 15 and 18 years the option to retire early and would instead separate them without retirement benefits, meaning that transgender service members will now be faced with the choice of either taking a lump sum separation payment offered to junior troops or be involuntarily removed from service. That move is but one of the ramifications of the current administration's policy of banning all transgender troops from the United States military, a ban upheld by the Supreme Court this past May, Both the ban and the decision to uphold it are themselves typewriter eraser moments. I thought about typewriter erasers earlier this week when the United States State Department released its annual reports on international human rights. According to NPR, this year's reports drastically reduced the type of government repression and abuse that the United States under President Trump deems worthy of criticism. Categories such as restrictions on free assembly, unfair elections, and punishment of minority groups previously included in these reports dating back to the 1970s have been eliminated this year, as have any references to diversity, equity, and inclusion, sexual violence against children, and interference with privacy. References to restrictions on political participation, government corruption, violence against minorities and LGBTQ people, and harassment of human rights organizations were also removed. A recent executive order mandated that any exhibits, content deemed improper, divisive, or expressing anti-American ideology would be removed from the Smithsonian's museums. A typewriter eraser moment. The firing of the Librarian of Congress and the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Typewriter eraser moments. Hundreds of words and phrases removed from government websites, from woman to Gulf of Mexico, from underserved to climate change, typewriter eraser moments. Threats to jail unhoused people in Washington, D.C., or give them places to stay far from the Capitol, typewriter eraser moment. And all the anti-trans legislation introduced over the past 5 years and the previous 200 years are also typewriter eraser moments, each and every one of them. There is nothing new or unique to the United States about governments, institutions, faith communities, and powerful subsets of communities attempting to erase people and ideas from society. Efforts at erasure range from the steadfast refusal to use proper names and pronouns to outright genocide and include physical violence against bodies, economic suppression, redlining, the creation of ghettos, censorship, book bans, book burning, denial of medical care, mass incarceration, involuntary civil commitment, and bullying, among many other tactics. These efforts are united in their cruelty and destructiveness. Each left and each continues to leave devastation and death in its wake. Paradoxically, these efforts are also united in their universal ineffectiveness. The idea that a theology based on the concept of the Trinity is not biblically sound did not die with the execution of Michael Servetus, for example. Indeed, the smudges left by that attempt at erasure spread his idea through the ages, so that Servetus's idea remains one of the bedrock ideas on which Unitarianism and now Unitarian Universalism is founded. The colonization of the North American continent unfolded as a massive attempt at erasure, successive, simultaneous, and ongoing massive attempts, in fact, through genocide, forced removal from lands, involuntary boarding schools, cultural suppression and misappropriation, and false narratives. Countless people died, families were torn apart, communities ravished, languages brought to and over the brink of extinction. The entire land is covered with the visible and gaping holes created by those destructive but ultimately ineffective erasure efforts. And Native people today, living run-of-the-mill lives and lives of accomplishment and lives at the edges, on tribal lands, in cities, in small towns, and in homeless encampments, forming relationships, raising families, growing old, resurrecting traditional languages, teaching their histories, preserving practices and rituals, and engaging in every occupation imaginable. Native people today are the resilient smudges of those erasure attempts. The lynching of Matthew Shepard rubbed a hole clear through his family, his community. And the work of the Matthew Shepard Foundation is a life-giving smudge left behind. Matthew Shepard was killed but not erased, and his death didn't erase other gay people or cause a single person to become straight either. Removing stories of LGBTQI families and kids from school libraries and public libraries, purging the U.S. military of trans personnel, attempting to overturn Obergefell versus Hodges, the Supreme Court decision that legalized same-sex marriage, all these cause real psychic harm and financial hardship to families, individuals, and communities, but do not and cannot wipe them, wipe us out of existence or history. On and on. No smooth, clear, empty space is ever left behind an attempted erasure of an idea or person or group of people. A smudge is left on the paper. A hole is rubbed through the paper. The paper of science or democracy or culture or history still bears evidence of the facts and systems and ideas those who wield the erasers would have obliterated if only they could. The paper that is a family or a community still bears the vibrancy, love, and joy, heartbreak, and grief of the people those who wield the erasers would have obliterated if only they could. None of which is to say that attempts at erasure aren't destructive, life-destroying threats to the well-being not just of the individual and groups and ideas targeted, but to society as a whole. As people of faith, we are called to stop the harm. And one way we do that is by saying to the people with the erasers, your best efforts will never be successful. The smudges of the people, individuals, ideas that you seek to erase will always remain. But the whole that is the aftermath of your frantic, persistent, ineffective erasing harms our communities, harms our families, harms our neighbors, harms our society, and we will not let you continue. We will say the names of the people you kill lest they be forgotten. We will spread the ideas you seek to suppress. We will support counter-legislation. We will show up at school board meetings. We will run for school board. Elected officials, we will protest at your local, county, state, and congressional offices. We will vote. We will vote every time there is something to vote on. We will buy and sell the books you label a menace. We will tell the stories. We'll support mutual aid campaigns. We will get to know our neighbors because relationships build resistance and resilience. The fabric of our United States from before we were a country until 2025 is littered with holes left where someone tried to erase someone else, some idea, some group. The day will come when we are bold enough to start mending those holes in earnest with deliberation through reparation or truth and reconciliation type processes or other means of repair. Today, as the pace of attempts at erasure seems to be accelerating and the methods of erasure are both powerful and insidious, the task before us is to prevent the creation of more holes, taking action at the first sign of the eraser appearing. All of us together and each of us individually hold the holy and holy fragile fabric of our society in our hands. May we act wisely, prayerfully and daily to preserve it. Amen.
This is Reverend Lisa Day. I hope you've enjoyed this program from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Please join us at one of our services sometime soon at our church on Troop Square or live on Zoom. We're the beacon of liberal religion in Savannah, and you can find out more at uusavannah.org. We meet on Sundays at 11 a.m. Thanks for listening.